I'm John Neff, Global Editor-in-Chief of Motor One, and welcome to this week's episode of the MotorOne.com podcast. The all-electric Porsche Taycan Super Sedan is finally here. And like all new electric cars, comparisons between it and what Tesla's selling have already started. The most obvious matchup for the Taycan is the Model S. So on today's episode, each car is getting a champion in the form of a MotorOne.com editor, and we're going to duke it out to discover if a superior EV can be crowned. I will play the part of Tesla fanboy, which shouldn't be too hard because I own a Model 3 myself. Actually, my wife owns and drives it, but the point is, we put down our hard-earned cash on the side of Tesla already, and I've had plenty of practice defending that decision since we made it. In the Taycan's corner will be managing editor Brandon Turkus, who is the only one among us that's seen in person what the Taycan can do. He came back from that experience a changed man, a newfound EV acolyte, as long as the EV in question is a Porsche. And lastly, we need a referee, someone with no skin in the game who will keep Brandon and I from landing low blows and kidney punches on each other. That would be senior editor Greg Fink. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks, John. I wouldn't call myself a newfound acolyte, but...
We'll find out. Let's see.
I would classify that as the first of the low blows.
Many more to come, my friend. Many more to come.
And I didn't really want to be the ref. Nobody loves the ref. The ref always gets the short end of the stick, but I'm happy to be the ref.
Yeah, actually, in my days watching WWE, the ref usually lands on the mat unconscious, so that could happen here. I would be expecting that.
Well, people boo the ref. Nobody ever cheers the ref. The ref is either neutral, like to the fans, or the worst guy in the game, or girl.
That's true. Well, let's see what you can do with the job. All right, so I want to start with some opening arguments. Just some, you know, so Brandon and I have a chance to kind of say our piece without the other interrupting. Since this week is the Porsche Taycan's big week, it's big debut, it's big coming out party. Brandon, I'll let you go first and give your thoughts on the debate we're about to have.
I flew down to Atlanta and visited Porsche's Experience Center a couple weeks ago and got a really in-depth, deep look at everything that goes into this car. I got to go for a ride along on the track. I've written about both of those experiences on the website. The debut post alone has nearly 3,000 words. It's a really in-depth look at it. And it's interesting to see a legacy automaker's take on a modern high-performance EV. There's a very German Porsche-like attitude to this car. But where I really see it setting itself apart from Tesla is in terms of build quality and the way the technology works and the thought that goes into it. Porsche is designing a car, not that it's going to make constant little tweaks on it. It's going to be as good as it can get in terms of user experience direct from the factory. Beyond that, you have to think about what this car represents to current Porsche owners. It's a product for them. It is an electric car for them. And that means a couple of things. It means that it's going to drive and perform just as a Porsche should. This car is an unbelievable performer. But more than that, it's also going to mean more accessibility than Tesla. There are more Porsche dealerships. Service is going to be easier to acquire. There are a ton of things about this vehicle beyond, you know, the range and the supercharger network and the normal things that Tesla fans are hyping about that is going to make it stand out.
Well, those are all good points. And you may not believe it, but I think during this debate, I'll actually have a lot of good things to say about the Taycan too. Let me lay out a few facts. The Model S is vastly less expensive than the Taycan. As a matter of fact, their base prices right now are $70,000 apart. For the price of a Taycan, you could buy the entire Tesla lineup. That's how far apart these are in price. The Model S is also larger inside and out. It's a bigger car. It has a far, far greater range, like 100 miles more. Technically quicker to 60 miles per hour, even though it's not a huge gap. It also has a higher top speed, again, even though it's not a huge gap. And it actually weighs less despite being larger and doing all of those other things. So those are the facts that I would put in the Model S corner. And that doesn't even include the supercharger network and things like that. For the Taycan, I'll say it probably handles a lot better than the Model S. You know, if for no other reason than it's Porsche pedigree. Probably has superior build quality. Tesla really hasn't set the bar that high in that regard. and it has a better service experience. You know, again, Tesla hasn't set that bar very high as well. That's how I see the pieces on the board. My question is, are those areas in which the Taycan wins worth such a huge price difference, considering all the categories the Model S wins? And the last thing I'll say is a remark on the last thing you said, which is that this is a car for Porsche people. This is a car that Porsche built to stop its own fans, its own buyers, from buying a Tesla. Porsche didn't plan to beat the Tesla. They only planned to make a car good enough that a Porsche fan wouldn't buy a Tesla. To me, with the pricing, and we can give the specific pricing in a second, they're gouging the Porsche fans for that honor to own one of these instead of a Tesla.
That's a little bit of a disingenuous argument. I mean, first of all, we know that more affordable Taycans are coming. We know that there will be a base model and a Taycan
right,
S.
But the less expensive ones will have even worse specs in terms of range and performance.
How do you figure that the less powerful models will have worse range? That doesn't math.
Yeah, the battery pack might be the same. The power might
The battery pack is almost certainly going to be the same.
Likely going to be the same. And I'd like to add too, although the Porsche, which we should say the price for the Turbo S, the highest powered one, is $185,000. That's more than obviously that's the top end, but that's more than $100,000 than the base Model S. But that is a little cheaper even than a Panamera Turbo S e-hybrid, which is the top Porsche. So Porsche is in the business, whether you think that's charging too much or that's a fair price, but they're in the business of charging this type of money for this amount of performance from a four-door sedan-like vehicle.
And clearly, if they're doing that, they've been doing that with the Panamera for so long, and the Taycan's prices already mirror the Panamera very closely. They know there's a business case for this vehicle. They know that they will sell every single one that they build.
Well, they're also limiting production. It's not like they're just opening the floodgates and are going to sell.
They have 30,000 pre-orders. I'd hardly call that limiting production.
We got 30,000 people.
I thought pre-orders were the end-all be-all, according to Tesla fans.
Yeah.
I mean, Tesla has actual sales. I mean, the amount of Model 3s that get sold
but
in a
they're
month.
They're not making money, so.
The amount of Model 3s sold in a month is more than most U.S. luxury automakers.
And it took them 2 years to ramp up to that. This car is going to go on sale in December. And like I said, they're not going to be able to keep them in stock.
They're charging a Porsche premium for it. I think you're exactly right. They know they can get away with charging these prices because they've been doing it with their gas cars as well. And that's fine. All I think higher end brands and you know, sellers of sports car, you know, there's always a amount of padding they put in just for the honor to own their brand. If you're talking about, I mean, I don't really want to talk about what the Taycan can do versus a Panamera. I don't think that's the point of the Taycan. The point is it a good electric vehicle?
I think at the top end of the Taycan, though, Turbo S, and I know I'm the ref who's supposed to be a little more moderate here, but I do think the Turbo S is to some degree designed, and you even said it earlier, John, that they're trying to get Porsche people not to leave Porsche. It's designed somewhat to be an alternative to the Turbo S Panamera. Obviously, there's a large group that's also going to look at it as a alternative to a Tesla Model S performance or other electric vehicles. But I think at the high end, they see this as a car that's as it is an electric car. It's a performance car, too. Once we get to the lower ones that we haven't seen yet, your statement, I think, applies more where it is. What does this do as an electric car more? Because we're at a price that is more comparable to other electric cars. The performance isn't. It's still going to be probably very good, but it's not that out of this world performance.
Well, and by the way, the reason I said when they have less expensive Taycans that the range will be smaller is that's what I'm used to seeing at Tesla. They have standard range models and long range models. So if they're going to have, I don't know if we have a confirmation.
Well, Model S now is only long range and performance. They got rid of the standard range.
Right, you're right. Yeah, Model 3 has standard range and long range and performance. But I don't know. I don't know if you have information from Porsche that the regular Taycan, the non-turbo models, will have more range than the performance models. But
I don't have that information. But it wouldn't surprise me if it's
The turbo. The turbo already has more range than the Turbo S. So QED, the Taycan S, will likely have longer range than the turbo, and the normal Taycan will have probably a slightly longer range than the Taycan.
Well, again, that's not the way it goes over at Tesla, where
Porsche's been doing this a little bit longer.
But I also think that's assuming they're going to keep the same battery pack, which I will say makes the most sense for them to do that.
Even if they keep the exact same battery pack, they may software limit it to a lower range in order to get people to buy up into the turbo.
But I think part of the thing is too for Porsche right now, as you mentioned, its range is significantly less than the Tesla. But I don't think it's enough personally it's over the 200 to 250 mile threshold. I think that's enough for most consumers, and it's not the best at all. It's a lot worse than the Tesla if we're going to go apples to apples. But I think it's enough that most consumers will say. That's fine enough. If you go too low, you start entering the threshold of, is that enough? And I don't think they have a lot of room to go lower in their battery pack. If anything, I think it's possible we'll see a slightly bigger battery pack or more efficient battery pack that squeezes some more range out of the car in the near future.
It'll just be less powerful electric motors to stretch it.
But I just think they're at the point where they can't really afford to go with significantly less range than what the car already has.
I agree. If they did, it would get too close to 200.
And then it's
as we've seen,
point.
Audi has been heavily criticized with the e-tron for barely getting over 200 miles with its range. 250 is not bad. I agree that it's more than most people need. As a matter of fact, GM taught us back when the Volt first came out that 30 miles of range is what 80% of people need to deal with their daily driving. So 250 is plenty. However, again, when people are shopping for EVs, it's a huge difference between 258 miles or 280 miles for the Taycan versus 367 miles and 380 miles for the Model S. That's a huge difference. That's 100 miles of difference. And having owned an EV for a little while, it makes a difference on two counts. One is obviously it makes a difference with long trips. You can go 100 miles more, and that's important. And especially since not only can you go 100 miles more in the Tesla, but the supercharger network is larger and has more charge points than charging network that Porsche is going to be using for the next 2 years.
I think that's the more important point than the range.
John, in the time that you've had your Tesla, how many times have you needed to use 90% of its range in one sitting?
Twice. When we go on road trips. I mean, when we go to visit my wife's parents or her brother in Pennsylvania.
And you've had the car for how long now?
A couple months.
Sorry to interject, but I think that might be a positive of the lower range. Sorry, folks, can't go visit you. Would love to. Don't have the range.
These are all in-laws. Yeah.
First of all, you're not using that range often. Is my point. You might be using it a little bit more than most, but you're not using it that often. It's not a critical element. And you talk about the supercharger network is so much bigger. Well, yes, it is bigger, but Electrify America's network is not small. It's going to be adding 270 kilowatt charging capacity that will bring this battery from 5 to 80% in 22 and a half minutes. Even at 150 kilowatt charger, it'll go from 5 to 80% in about half an hour, a little over half an hour. So, and that network is already expanding across freeways. There's going to be 600 stations across the country by 2020, I believe. And two of those chargers at each station will be 270 kilowatts capable.
Okay, but so, it's estimated that the Electrify America charge network won't be as big as Tesla's until 2021, at least 2 years from now. Plus, there are fewer charge points at each station than there are at Tesla superchargers. Plus, Tesla has an adapter so that every Tesla can charge not only at a supercharger, but also at an Electrify America charger. So basically, that just kills the argument, of which has the larger network. The Tesla.
It's not about the size of the network. It's about the overall accessibility of it. And I'm saying the accessibility is going to be enough that the number of stations for most people won't matter. People aren't going to drive this car across country. In fact, I would be surprised if they went more than one or two stations down the freeway.
See, I think that's a terrible argument.
Yeah, I have to disagree as well. I mean, what is the map function in the car that you pay extra for because it's Porsche, so you have to pay extra for, but the function where it tells you the best route to get between charging stations, and it'll tell you maybe a slightly longer one if it gets you to a station that will charge quicker. So it seems like the car is designed to go distances. And even if it's not fully, let's be honest, there's always going to be somebody who's going to try to prove that it can go far distances. And it's not a good PR look from the start if it's like, well, so-and-so, the guy who went, you know, across the country in 3 days in a, you know, Chevy Avalanche just tried to do it in a Tesla and succeeded, but then he went in the Porsche and immediately failed because Electrify America wasn't ready for it.
In the southern United States, you could drive hitting Electrify America stations right now across the country. Like, the capability is
there. That's great. That's great. But as good as the Electrify America network gets, that only makes the situation better for Tesla owners.
Yeah.
Because they can charge it both. And I think it's not a good argument to say that most people aren't going to drive long distances, because that's not how American buyers of cars think.
No, I'm not.
They
I'm
want
not
that
capability. It's not the only factor in it. And
they want Tesla that capability, whether they're going to use it or not. That's 100% true of American buyers. Otherwise, we'd all be driving around really great electric vehicles that have 100 miles.
Well, I want to play both sides real quick, of you guys. I want to side with John first by saying I do think, not only is Supercharger already there in a better network as is, the fact that it's gaining more stations for Tesla people that as Electrify America goes on. Tesla clearly has, if not significantly superior in 2 or 3 years, has an edge here. But the Porsche has an edge that Brandon didn't bring up yet, and I'm sure he's getting near. It's charging speeds. He started mentioning it, but because it's on this, it's ready for 800-volt charging. Is that the correct way to phrase it?
Yeah.
800-volt charging. Yeah. It is ready to charge. It is ready for a future of faster charging than the Teslas currently are.
Well, I will say than the Tesla Model S. The Tesla Model 3 can already charge at 250 kilowatts, and Tesla's already upgrading its chargers.
But it's not 800-volt architecture. That's the thing. Once this,
what did that do? It's about the speed, the 250 kilowatt speed.
No, it's what's necessary to allow 400 to 500 kilowatt charging rates. Okay, it is future proofing for the next generation of charging technology.
Okay, I mean,
it's about the equivalent, though. Honestly, it's about the equivalent of Tesla putting all the cameras on its cars that don't work for full self driving yet, and they're prepared for that. You know, in theory, whenever it comes, the car is ready for it. And Porsche is kind of doing the same with their cars; just they're choosing charging rather than full self driving in this instance.
But I want to kind of circle back, because when was the last time that anyone was saying, you know, an ICE powered car? No one talks about range this much.
200, 250 miles is more than enough for anybody. The Porsche and every electric car is still in the phase of having to convince people to convert. And 370 miles, probably nobody will ever use that much. Nobody will ever use the full 250 or whatever the final number is for the Porsche. But it's a lot easier to be convinced to convert when you have that much range.
Taycan with the longest range, which is the current base Taycan Turbo, can go 280 miles. That makes it the very first production electric car.
I don't think that's official figure, by the way, because the EPA is not tested.
Oh, you're right.
It's a WLTP
Yeah,
figure.
So it's you're probably right. going to be a little lower, too. So I would
guess
250, 260.
All right. Well, that might hurt the point I'm making. That's kind of a backhanded compliment to the Taycan. But the Elon Musk made this point a few months ago at a keynote. The 2012 Model S, when it first came out, had a range of 260 miles. And as of 2 months ago, not a single electric production car that has come out since then, including the ones that have come out just this past year, have been able to eclipse the 260 mile range of a five-year-old car. And the Taycan might be the first to do it, although we don't know. The EPA ratings aren't come out. So even if it does it, it's going to be close. And I've always wondered, and I think anybody can ask this question, whether they are a Tesla, you know, fanboy or a Tesla hater, is what is the voodoo magic that Tesla has to create cars, because I think this goes for the Model 3 as well, that have incredible range, incredible performance in terms of power and acceleration. Why can't these other manufacturers, you know, particularly Audi and Mercedes and Jaguar, who have come out with production EVs, why can't they come anywhere close to matching Tesla? What magic are they using that?
Well, I think,
and Porsche has taken its best swing, and it's a better swing than those other three I just mentioned, but I still don't think it's a swing that gets anywhere close to the you know, element, all the elements put together that a Tesla offers.
I think Brandon probably will articulate the answer to that question better than I will, so I'm going to leave the answer to that to him, unless he really doesn't want to. But I just want to point out, when you're saying Elon's thing about how, you know, the original Model S go 260 miles and no one else has done that yet, That is impressive, but that's kind of like Dodge saying, hey, our Hellcat, you know, Demon made nearly 900 horsepower, whatever the number was. It was a ridiculous number. I don't know why I'm blanking out. The Red Eye 797. And yet the GT500 and ZL1 don't come close, and it's been, what, 4 years? But nobody's saying, oh, man, those are underpowered cars. That's not enough. There's a certain point.
I don't
point
think that's apples to apples.
No,
that's
not apples. That is completely apples to apples. That
no,
is
I wouldn't say apples it to is, apples, but it's green apple to red apple. It's still in the same ballpark.
Yeah,
the range is something that electric cars are trying to increase to match ICE vehicles.
And
we're not even there yet.
Kind
not
of
even
reached that point at over 200 miles. Now I think it's, and I agree
no.
with you, John.
What new gas powered car has a 200 mile range?
I was just in a Mitsubishi Mirage that I had to fill up every 190 miles, according to the range calculator.
A Mitsubishi Mirage is what you're going to throw.
No, but I'm just saying, I just think that, you know, there's a certain point where it's nice to have more, and Tesla's definitely winning here, and more is good, but there's also the reality of there's an enough point.
I think a big part of why these legacy automakers have not chosen to do this is because they are looking beyond just getting squeezing as much range out of these cars as possible. Take the Taycan, for example. So it doesn't have the range. Okay, that's fine. But it's more aerodynamic, and more importantly, it's performance.
Look at the figures.
Let me finish.
Barely
and more, but more importantly, what it can do in terms of performance, in terms of outright ability, and how you can drive it, is repeatable and constant. You can beat the hell out of that car from a full charge to 0%.
That's a worthless feature.
you're gonna
use that on a track at a first drive event. How many owners are going to go to a track with their Taycan and do that?
How many owners are going to use all 370 miles of charge on their Tesla Model S?
Having owned an electric vehicle, it's not about how far you go on one trip. It's also about how many days you go without charging. And it's nice to go a week or more without charging, as opposed to charging it every day or every other day.
Yeah, I was going
to
mention.
It'd be like if you had to go to a gas station every 2 days.
Except I have to take 5 seconds and plug something in to, you know, my car. That's much more difficult, I'm sure.
I actually agree with you that there is a enough point. I just don't agree that it's 200 miles. I think it's 300 miles.
This is a 250-mile car.
Yeah, which is 50 miles less than 300. I think 300 is the enough point.
I mean,
for electric vehicles.
Well, I just want to take a quick minute. I think this is a very big breakthrough. We can all agree that there, even if we think the enough point is a different point, we agree there is an enough point, and there is also a point of where it's nice to have more, but you don't really need more. And that's where Tesla's reached, I think. And again, I'm not hating on Tesla for that. I would want more range. I even argued that in our, you know, how would you spec your Porsche Taycan? But I also am a realist and realize, to me, I think 200, 250 is the number. But if it's 300, there is a point where we're just kind of taking more because we can.
Yeah, but you already said it, Greg, though. The ones that have come in between 200 and 250, they get criticized in comments and online for coming in at 200 to 250. Whether that's right or wrong, they're getting negative, I think, both press and reaction from
regular
people.
That's like the muscle car fanboys hating on Ford for not making the, you know, enough power out of the GT500 to battle the Demon.
Yeah,
it is.
You can't.
Yeah,
put,
I'll let you go on, Brandon.
You can't say that you have, you know, a corral of people commenting on the internet and say that is consensus. Like, you have no idea who they are. You have no idea what motives they have. They are just voices.
Let me phrase that argument in a different way. All these automakers can build whatever EV they want. If they want an EV that will critically come out on top of Tesla, they have to beat Tesla. And I don't think they're choosing to produce cars with 200 to 250 miles of range because they think that they don't have to, you know, hit 300 to beat Tesla. I think they're doing that because they can't. They haven't figured it out. They don't have either the engineering know-how or the expertise to make a car on the same level as Tesla. And Jalopnik made a great video that tore down the batteries and the motors of the Tesla Model 3, the Chevy Bolt, and I can't remember what the third one was. Might have been the Volt or something else. Anyway, they did a great job of pulling back all the layers, all the way down to the batteries and the battery chemical makeup and the cells to show what's the difference between the Tesla and the GM and the others. And they're more advanced.
Okay, so let's go ahead and assume that you're right and that legacy automakers don't have the ability to make a battery as well as, you know, Tesla.
I mean, it's more than just a battery. Everything goes into it, but go ahead.
A battery and electric motor, but in every other way, besides being an EV, the e-tron, the EQC, the I-Pace, the Leaf, the Volt, or the Bolt, and the Taycan are better cars. In every single way.
Be more specific. What are those ways?
Their technology is smarter. They're better built. They're more.
What do you mean they're I don't know what you mean by what the technology is smarter. That's vague.
The technology, the user experience in those cars is better. It's more familiar. It's been tested.
I don't think it's familiar, but I don't think it's better. I like it more. I agree with you, Brandon, but I think there is a big group of people who love the Tesla experience, and I don't necessarily think it's the best overall, but it appeals to people.
It is fine. These legacy cars are better built. They're more solid. They feel.
I've already given you that.
We've harped on how the Teslas are better in terms of range for the past 20 minutes. Like, let's talk about quality. You know, when you get into an EQC or an e-tron, it feels every bit as good as an A8 or an S-Class. You get into a Model 3, and I finally drove my first Model 3 a couple weeks ago, and I couldn't believe it had an echo. Like, there was actually an echo from the tinniness in it.
The lack of legacy of Tesla, kind of learning on the fly, you do notice.
Yeah, 100%. 100% agree. I think Tesla swung for the fences on a lot of innovation and you know, not being a legacy automaker.
But they forgot to do some of the things that good cars do.
Hold on. They swung for the fences because they had the opportunity to be innovative and start from scratch and not follow any of the rules that automakers often hold themselves to. And on some cases, they hit a home run, and on other cases, they whiffed. I think the Falcon doors on the Model X are the best example of something they totally didn't have to do that didn't help them in any way. Like, regular doors
down
are just
production
fine.
Of that car that could have been making
but
money.
But did you ever think did you ever think the rules that were there that legacy automakers did were there for a reason?
It depends on the rule. You absolutely can't say that for everything. No, I think there's tons of things about like the Model 3 that we drive that I love that an automaker.
I mean,
would
I think
never
even Porsche's breaking some of those rules with the Taycan. That extra screen in front of the passenger is a pretty cool feature that is not the norm.
I think it's a cool gimmick, though.
I mean, it makes sure the passenger is able to control some of the infotainment features. I don't think it's necessary, but if you're already spending that much,
unless it does something like exclusive for the passenger rather than just being redundant to the screen that's 2 inches to the left of it, then to me it seems like a gimmick.
Okay, but so let's talk about then the one of the really important things that legacy automakers have focused on, and it is repeatability of performance. I'm specifically talking about cooling. Tesla has a well-documented history of their cars overheating when pressed. Now, how is that okay that you can't drive your car the way that you want to without fear of it overheating?
Anyone who watches Tesla over the past, over 10 years, knows that unlike legacy automakers, they have the ability and have taken advantage of this ability to improve cars on the fly. So
we'll give you that. That is one thing I admire about them.
So cooling issues have improved with software updates and things like that as they figure out what the parameters of their battery packs are and how far they can push them and things like that. Second, while I don't think anyone necessarily likes when, you know, an overheating warning comes on, they're extremely good about the software protecting the battery pack, which is ultimately what I want in the end.
Don't worry. The car won't overheat simply because it wants to protect the battery pack instead of just cooling properly in the first place. That's the thing. The Taycan is designed so that cools every time.
Yeah, that's like great. So you think that somebody is going to do a 0-60 blast 30 times in a row more often than they're going to drive to their in-laws' house in the next state over?
Well, I'm going to use the same argument that you used. They should be able to. They have that ability. If they want to do that, they can.
I guess, but I think one is an ability that people want to make sure they have access to all the time more than the other. For instance, I think in terms of Tesla, being able to go 0 to 60 in a Model S in 2.3 seconds, you know, faster than the Taycan, is actually a great thing, because giving people rides in a Tesla and flooring it and pressing them back in the seat and giving them that grin is like the best ambassador to showing people what EVs can do.
But I think that's an EV thing, because when we had the I-Pace here, I was doing similar things, and I know that I-Pace is nowhere near as quick as the Model S, you know, performance or a Model 3 performance, and it's still, it's the 0 to 20 more than the 0 to 60 that gets you. I mean, it's nice you can do 0 to 60 that quick, but it's that immediate 0 to 20.
I mean, yes,
I would also like to argue real quick that Porsche is citing 2.6. Porsche has a history of sandbagging its numbers. I would not be surprised if independent testing, we're going to be faster.
We're going to get a Taycan and a Model S in a drag race video.
I'm going to draw a small conclusion here from listening to you guys, which is kind of the conclusion I admittedly came in with to a little bit of a degree, which is if I want a performance car, I think the Porsche is the one to get over a Model S performance, because it's made
of course.
For it.
And I agree with that.
Well, I'll have to drive it, obviously. I'm going purely off conjecture. But they're saying it's made for repeatability, as Brendan has said. And it's a Porsche. I mean, their engineers are some of the best at making great driving cars. I'm sure the car drives amazing. But it is very hard to argue with the Model S long range if you want an electric car that also is pretty quick and looks nice, because it is bigger inside. It's goes farther. Right now, there is a real supercharger network, and it's about $60,000 cheaper than the cheapest Taycan for now. So I don't know if you guys have more you want to say, or if we want to say, yeah, that's, we're kind of not going to get to an evenness, but we can all kind of agree that makes some sense.
I think in the grand tradition of like Ford versus Chevy arguments and Apple versus Microsoft arguments, we are never going to see eye to eye. So I don't think Brandon and I have a hope of converting each other.
I would say if I'm looking for me personally, after hearing this, and maybe that's what, you know, listeners take away is the ref side of things, which is if you want an electric car and range is important, you're not going to do better. There maybe eventually you'll do better, but right now that Model S long range is very tough to beat. If you're looking for a performance car that also happens to be electric, the Porsche sounds pretty great.
I'm going to say exactly what I said, I believe to you, John, shortly before I went on this program, before I went on the backgrounder for the Taycan, that I think this car is going to be the start of several bad years for Tesla. I think this is just the harbinger to a whole new level of competition that it's never had to deal with before.
I couldn't disagree more. 90% of Tesla's sales are the Model 3, and this isn't going to affect Model 3 sales whatsoever.
But here's the thing you got to remember. The technology that's in this car is in the rest of the Volkswagen group.
Yeah, but we have the ID3 coming out, and again, that's
Audi's doing a version of this car though too, so
Let's wait and see and have this argument again for each of those. And like I said, I am waiting for an automaker to find the voodoo magic to put together all the elements to have, you know, a 300 plus mile electric car for a reasonable price that has incredible performance. And, you know, sure, I'd like it to be cool as well. I'm waiting for that. And it's still, I don't think the Taycan has done that. I think it moved the bar ahead in a few cool areas. I think it's a super cool car. If what was most important to me was performance, then I might go for that. But I don't think it's a better electric
car.
Well,
here's the other thing too, that when you were saying, John, that you don't think these other automakers have the technology yet to make a battery pack that can go as far as the Teslas do, which may or may not be true, but it's also probably a mentality. Tesla's an American automaker. Just like historically, you know, we like big Cadillacs and big V8s. It's a wide country here. We want to go far. Porsche, Audi, they're German. They're European. They're used to, you know, shorter distances. It very likely could just be a, you know, mentality of the people developing the vehicle.
It could be no different than back in the day when, you know, British sports cars were all four cylinders and we were over here with big V8s.
I mean, it could be a technology thing, but
could totally be a
cultural thing. I do think it is also a bit of a cultural thing. Like they, you know, they're thinking from a German mindset, saying, hey, 250 miles is plenty for the way people drive around here. And I still think it's fine for here. But then again, American auto journalists are known to think like Europeans, you know, like we want little, you know, four cylinder sports cars. So I'll give that, maybe I'm in the wrong there, but it very much could be just the mentality of the world they live in.
I think it's less likely a cultural thing, like you just explained, and more likely the fact that these automakers have an entire business model right now that's built on selling gas-powered cars. And they have to be very, very careful when they start selling battery-powered cars, because they are either going to lose money on each one, or the profit margins are going to be so much smaller than what they're earning on those gas-powered cars. So they have to manage the transition to a battery-powered business model very, very carefully, or else they risk incredible financial damage. So I think they're just being very, very cautious.
I think they're being very cautious for a different reason. And this goes back to something I've argued for a long time, is that in a lot of ways, what Tesla does with its business model, with charging ahead with new features and new technologies and all of these things, is can be a bit reckless. I think that the approach that we're seeing from legacy automakers is much more conservative. It's designed for making sure that these cars are absolutely ready and they're held to the same standards as their gas-powered models. So I think there's a very different approach than what you're insinuating, John.
I think it could be a combination of the two.
That's entirely
I actually agree with you. But I think it's up to each individual to decide whether that's a bad or good thing, or some combination of the both. I think Tesla has made itself free to pursue innovation at a much faster pace than
legacy
automakers.
Well, and they have to, because their only vehicles are electric vehicles. Whereas, like, you know, Porsche has a little bit more room to be like, oh, we're losing some money on this because people don't like the range or whatever, but we have all these other cars that make profits and can make up for it. Tesla has to come out strong, because there's no, well, if you don't like the way this one is, here's the gas-powered version.
It almost seems to me that all of these automakers that have come out with their own models don't want them to succeed. Like, they want to be shown putting a good foot forward, but they don't want to knock it out of the park. I think
very early in the life cycles of I-Pace and e-tron and all that stuff to be saying that.
Tesla has been making cars that go this far, that are this affordable, for many years now. So these automakers have had a pretty long time to plan what they're going to do and develop it and come out with it. And I think on their, you know, this is all their first efforts usually, unless they've, you know, converted gas-powered cars like Ford did with the Focus, and that was a terrible, terrible car with, you know, like 70 miles of range. But, you know, I thought they were all going to take their best swing at it with their first shot, and it just doesn't feel like they did. I agree they've all made good cars. I don't think they've made good electric cars.
I mean, I'd rather have a good car personally.
I think most people who are buying electric cars right now want a good electric car. There's plenty of good cars out to buy. But if you are choosing to be, and I don't even know if you can call people who buy electric vehicles now still early adopters. I don't know where we're at in that period. But people who are buying EVs now want good EVs. They're not choosing them just because, you know, they're there and available. They're making an active choice to buy that kind of car.
I think they have been treated so far with nothing but good EVs, and now there are going to be good cars that happen to be EVs coming, and that's where it's going to start to go bad for Tesla.
In order for that to happen, they have to start matching Tesla's magic and start putting up putting up technology and specs and range and all of that stuff that matches Tesla. And again, we're looking at a Porsche Taycan that costs $70,000 to $100,000 more than a Model S, and has 50 to 100 miles less range, and yes, handles better, but isn't faster. If you wanted to destroy Tesla, go ahead, but I don't think the Taycan destroys the Model S in any way.
I just think it's a slightly different
in any way.
To be honest, I think the Porsche people really care about the way the car is going to handle in a way that Tesla people don't.
Of course.
The thing too that's kind of interesting about this, especially with Volkswagen Group choosing Porsche to be the ambassador to this and not say Audi, which is going to have their e-tron GT or whatever it ends up being called, is that Porsche people are probably about the top four most annoying people in the auto. And I, as somebody who likes Porsches a lot, I would almost consider myself one. Top four most annoying people in the auto industry, along with Tesla people, Jeep people, and maybe there's one more I'm not thinking of. So it is a, yeah, Corvette people. It's a good group to have to, you know, rally around, where I don't think you two having this argument or discussion is going to be the only time it happens, not only among like media people, but just people at, you know, the local Cars and Coffee or the local, you know, meetup, they're going to be like, hey, I love Porsche and I'm going to defend it even if some of this doesn't make sense. Or I love Tesla and I'm going to defend it even if some of this doesn't make sense. They'll probably be even more hardcore than you guys are because you're neutral enough to realize like some of these things, maybe it fails in that regard.
Three things that the Taycan was better at. It handles better, it has better build quality, and it'll have a better service experience. The last two things, build quality and service experience, pretty much every other EV on the market can say that over Tesla. So that's not new. The Taycan, that's not the Taycan bringing something new.
But
to
it's
the table.
Also not the any only less
thing,
significant.
The only new thing the Taycan brings to the table is that it handles better than the Tesla.
No, the repeatability.
I think for a performance buyer, I don't think the average electric buyer necessarily cares about that. But if you're a performance electric buyer, that is a big thing.
The tech-minded early adopters are often people with high incomes that have a lot of money to spend. I think they would definitely consider a Porsche as much as they would consider a Tesla if they're not already.
But like, they're the ones who are going committed. For the, you know, the statement it makes, and they probably don't care about the repeatability. The person who's going because it's a Porsche specifically, and they're like, I want a performance vehicle, that's an important factor, and the Tesla does not match that. Is that a big amount of people that they're attracting? Because that probably not, but it is. There is a group of people that's going to be a very big appeal to.
In terms of the repeatability, I think, A, the usefulness is... You know, the practical usefulness is pretty low on that. And also, you know, Porsche made a big deal about the repeatability of the Taycan's performance. I'd like to see some people do some videos comparing, you know, a current Model S, the latest version with all the software updates to the Taycan in that regard. Because I will happily
sign up to torture test those two.
Yeah, fine.
And I think that Porsche is going to walk away from it.
Even if it does win, again, you know, I'll flip it and use the argument against you. To what degree is enough in terms of repeatability? How many 0-60 launches do you want? If you think that 200 miles of range is enough, then how many 0-60 launches is enough?
Well, right now, 26 that we know of, so I'm good with that. That's more than a Tesla could do.
How many do you need to make yourself feel comfortable? Like that's why, to me, nobody ever asked themselves how many.
What does a gas car do? It should be a lot. But the reality is, how many times do you really need to do that? Not much. And that's why I think the majority of buyers, except for the hardcore performance people, will realize that's not an end-all be-all. But if you, for whatever reason, are like, I'm going to be the guy who has an electric car that I'm taking to the track, you know, it's not even just 0-60 launches. It's just keeping the battery cool enough for a full lap around, say, VIR or something.
A real quick point. Like, I want to expand on what we were just talking about a little bit. So talking about repeatability, and we're only thinking about it in terms of performance, right? It's really important to think of the Taycan as, like I said in the debut post, other EVs are kind of proof of concept models. This is a broadside, but it's also proof of concept. It's showing what Tesla can do, and the repeatability is going to bleed over to when they finally build a Cross Turismo that can, you know, that they can actually tow something with.
If you tow something with a Porsche that has a 250-mile range, its range is immediately going to drop incredibly. Like, range becomes even more important when you're towing. The overheating that's happened with Teslas has been when performance stuff has been happening.
That's what I was going to say. I'm not trolling the message boards nonstop, but I've never really heard of having issues when towing or lots of people in the vehicle, heavy payload. But I have heard of Tesla issues when it comes to, high performance driving where the battery overheats and you go into a limp mode until it cools down.
Okay. I think we've pushed this rock up a hill as far as we can, and we need to let it roll back down on top of us. Brandon, a virtual shake of the hand. Thank you for going toe to toe. This has actually been fun. I miss conversations like this. Reminds me of when I was 12 and arguing with somebody over Sega versus Nintendo. Sega forever, by the way.
Sony PlayStation here.
It took me a while to convert to Sony, but I do want to hear what I think we all want to hear what you guys have to think, as in you who are listening. So please find us on Facebook and Twitter at Motor1.com, where we're going to continue this discussion on all of the articles we're writing about the Taycan. And of course, on our website, Motor1.com, where we have published, what did you say, Brandon? We've published like 31 articles in 9 languages today about the Taycan.
That was as of a couple hours ago. I have a feeling that we might have a couple more up, especially with our other editions.
We did have a comment on our podcast that I wanted to share from last week. You may recall last week we talked about the Audi RS6 Avant and then kind of went into a bigger discussion about what happened to station wagons. We got a comment from Blake S. and he says, I'll be honest, I'm a little shocked everyone brought up a Volvo or the Ford Taurus, but no Cadillac CTS-V wagon. I thought that would have been number one. Blake, right after we stopped recording, Chris Smith immediately said, oh my God, we didn't mention the Cadillac CTS-V wagon. So it definitely came to mind just a few seconds too late. And it definitely would have been on our list of one of the best wagons of all time. My only gripe against that one was it was kind of a vestigial wagon. The rear, the slope of the rear was so extreme that it didn't really allow you to put kind of big and bulky items in. So its practicality suffered a little, but man, that was an absolutely great car. What about you guys? Do you have a favorite wagon?
Mine
How about you, Greg?
The one that got away, my Great White Buffalo. I used to own this 03 BMW 525i wagon with a 5-speed sport package, Kalahari. I don't know the way to pronounce words clearly, but it was beige. It was gorgeous. I should have never let it go. It was a great wagon. Not a ton of power, but it was, you know, E39 BMW 5 series. I wish we still got the 5 wagon here. We don't. And we don't even get the 5 GT anymore or the 6 GT. We don't even get any close things to wagons at BMW anymore. So,
yep, that's what's happened to the wagon in America. That's exactly what we talked about last week. What about you, Brandon?
Mine was the first wagon that I ever really spent a lot of time with. Was when I had my first job in the auto industry at one of the fleet companies. We had a red Audi A4 Avant with the 2-liter turbo and a 6-speed manual, and it had the black optic package, and it was just such a complete vehicle. It was wonderful to drive. It was very well built. The interior was great. Plenty of cargo room. It was all-wheel drive, so you could slide it around in the snow, and it was, I remember thinking it was the car that kind of opened my eyes to how versatile and good wagons could be. It was that car that converted me to being a wagon fan in the first place. And I, you know, with Audi announcing the RS6 Avant, I'm kind of hoping that they'll bring back the A4 Avant, you know, beyond the all road. But I'm not going to hold my breath on that. I wish they'd bring over the RS4.
That's really, I think, the point we came to last week was, you know, in this age of crossovers, wagons really were the first vehicles that could kind of do everything and do everything well. It had, you know, it had cargo capacity, it had real utility, but it drove like a car. They could be comfortable. They could be sporty. They could kind of be, they had, you know, all-wheel drive. They could be everything. And man, they just kind of lost the PR war to first to minivans and then to, you know, crossovers and SUVs, and it's a shame. And big props to the brands that keep them alive, like Volvo and some of the others. All right, coming up, we're going to find out what we've all been driving this week. Before the break, though, a reminder that if you're listening to this online, you can also get our show on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So please hit the subscribe button so you don't miss out on an episode. Welcome back. During this part of the show, we talk about what cars we're driving this week. And today, let's start with you, Brandon. What are you driving this week?
So I have just been spending a couple days with the Nissan Leaf Plus.
Speaking of electric vehicles.
We get to continue talking about electric vehicles. And aside from the Taycan, this is the only, and the Model X, this is the only electric vehicle on sale that I hadn't driven yet. And in case you're not familiar, the Plus model is the long range, the 62 kilowatt hour battery
in North America
that I believe Nissan rates at 215 miles to a charge. The car showed up at my house with a 95% charge and 226 miles showing of estimated range. I haven't driven it a great deal. I'm planning on putting a lot of miles on it this weekend, but based on my, you know, few miles puttering around, it's a very nice car. The seating position is a little bit odd, but the interior feels relatively well built. There's enough acceleration. The one pedal driving is really pleasant. It feels like a very good hatchback that, again, goes back to what I was saying earlier, just happens to be electric. I like the new style. I think it's been toned down nicely. It's still a little bit too modern for my taste, but it's nowhere near as crazy as original Leaf. But yeah, I've been very surprised with it, and I'm looking forward to spending more time with it.
Yeah, I have a lot of goodwill in my heart for Nissan with the Leaf, because out of all legacy automakers, they came out with a full-on electric vehicle very early, and most importantly, an electric vehicle of its own, not a converted gas car.
Well, and they stuck with it too.
Stuck with it, exactly.
Like has there been any second generation EV from any automaker, any legacy automaker yet?
Right. Exactly. Like, this is the only one. To me, they've proven it means more. Like they're seriously in it for all the right reasons. They're not coming to it late. They're not coming to it because they have to. They did this because they felt it was the right thing to do or the important thing to do. And they've stuck with it, and they've done some really good things with it. I think, you know, there are tons and tons of happy Leaf owners out there.
For a couple of reasons, I would rather have a Bolt. And it comes down to the seating position. I find the seating position in the Bolt to be more natural. I can't get the steering wheel far enough or close enough to me in the Leaf without like sliding my knees up and basically
I hate that.
Straddling the steering column. And so I feel a lot more comfortable in the Bolt. I personally like the styling of the Bolt a little bit more. It's one of the only GM products I'll say that about. I think the interior quality is a little bit better. I like the tech a little bit more. These are all marginal things, but the big thing is the Bolt is made 2 miles from where I grew up, and so I have to like it more.
Yeah, no, I have the same type of loyalties living in Cleveland to some Ford products. Also, the Bolt just got a fairly substantial bump in range.
Yeah, I'm really excited to try it.
2020,
out.
Yeah. So I think it's over 250 miles now. So there's a big gap in between the Bolt and the Volt now. But like I said, a lot of goodwill for Nissan, and they definitely get like a check mark, an E for effort, for sticking with the Volt so long and making a decent product.
The Leaf.
I'm sorry, the Leaf. making a decent product for so long. Although honestly, I could say that I could say the same thing about GM, because they got on board they made the EV1. All right, that's one thing. Although they got a lot of heat for how they ended that, but I think the Volt was actually an important step as well.
I'll never forgive GM for not doing more with the Volt's technology than the Volt and the ELR.
Yeah,
if they had done an Equinox size vehicle, just an Equinox with the Volt powertrain, my God, they would have sold everyone. It would have been a fantastic
car.
Or
if they just had the staying power.
That technology is so good.
If they just had the staying power that Nissan had and had developed it and got to a second generation Volt. You know, I think
if.
Yeah, but you're right. And actually, the second generation Volt is excellent. It's got a 50 miles.
It's really
of range.
Good. Honestly, if there's one thing, like I have been a really, really strong, well-known critic of GM. If there's one thing that I could just grab Mark Royce and like shake him and say, is give us more stuff like the Volt and the Bolt. You have the right technology. It is working well. It drives well. It's really fantastic. Just give us more of it. Ignore what the focus groups say and give us more.
Frankly, I honestly think the Volt still had legs. I mean, good plug-in hybrids are still being, new ones are still being made. Good ones are still being sold.
The two main problems with the Volt, it was, and I have one of my best friends owned a Volt. He had a second gen Volt for 3 years. The two biggest things that he complained about were backseat space, which was virtually non-existent because of the shape of the battery pack, and getting in and out, like the headroom. Those are both easily fixable things. Otherwise, he loved the technology.
Well, I don't know that the battery pack, they made that T-shaped battery pack rather than making the battery pack like a skateboard. And I think that was like a fundamental design flaw again, they could have fixed with another generation, maybe.
But here's the point I wanted to make is that, John, I know you are, we all know you're a Tesla fan and whatnot. I think the best electric car for most people would be a Volt crossover.
I mean, like I said, I said in our discussion that GM made the point with the original Volt that the original Volt's 35 miles could cover 80% of people's daily driving needs, because 80% of people don't drive more than 35 miles a day. So with a 50 mile range plug-in hybrid like the second gen Volt, it made it a much better case for itself. So again, I think if they had kept along that line, I think you're right, they would have had a really, really great vehicle.
But GM self-sabotage is legendary.
Indeed. All right, Greg, let's move on. What were you driving this past week?
I was in the 2019 Mazda 6 Signature, you know, the top-end one with the Turbo 4.
Doesn't it feel, though, the ones I've driven, when I look at the sticker and I see exactly what you get for upgrading to the Signature, it feels a little bit like a cash grab. It feels a little bit like they're like, oh, this is the Denali version for Mazda. This is like, I'm going to throw a little extra visual stuff at you and jack up the price.
Yeah, I think it's just, I don't have the Monroney with me, but I know from our long-term CX-5, it's like some different leather that's a little softer, the fake wood, I think it's real wood trim though, but it's nothing that's worth the couple thousand dollar, to me at least, you know, maybe to the right person that is worth it, and who am I to judge, but I would go the lower rung one if I wanted the top end.
I think it's still the Grand Touring. I think what a product planner at Mazda must have realized, which is a unfortunate truth about human nature, is if you make it, whatever the most expensive thing is, people will buy because it's the most expensive thing. So if they just make a more expensive top trim, it'll get sold. And I think GMC is maybe one of the first ones to stumble on that with their whole Denali line, where it's just like they found out early on, if we just make a more expensive version, people will buy it, and it almost doesn't matter what we change on it. They'll just buy it because they're the
type of people
who want
the best. And it's like 90% profit, those changes. It's like, okay, we'll add $10 worth of change. I don't know what the real dollars are, but you know, $10 worth of changes and charge $3,000 more. You know, it's very small changes that do not add up to the cost of what you pay extra for.
Yeah, and honestly, I kind of was surprised that I felt like, again, my perception of it was that Mazda was executing that strategy too, and it would only surprise me because Mazda didn't seem like the type of automaker to do that. Really, I mean, like it almost seemed like that's much more of an American domestic automaker kind of thing to do rather than
it does, but at the same time, I feel, you know, they've admittedly trying to go up market a little. I don't know if that eventually means going toward Lexus or just kind of living in this sort of how Volkswagen used to be, your Buick and Acura are now, this sort of in between. Yeah. But that's what kind of got GMC being seen as not just a GMC bad Chevy truck. It's, I don't know if premium is the right word, but it's a little bit above. And I think it's probably
maybe,
part of their
yeah.
strategy of, hey, if we can get some money out of this, that's cool. But also it's going to get the idea that we're not, you know, Toyota or Honda necessarily.
All right. So this past week, I have a pretty cool car. It arrived just yesterday. The Mercedes AMG GT53 four-door, which is a mouthful, four-door version of the Mercedes AMG GT. Brandon, you, I don't know if you warned me or kind of prepped me that I was going to have quite an experience with this car. And I have. It is, on the outside, it is perhaps the most beautiful car on sale today. I think it looks absolutely gorgeous. There's something about this class of car, because I fell in love with the original Audi A7, which is the same kind of classic car, the kind of large four-door coupe style. And this just takes it like it gave me the same kind of emotional charge as that first generation Audi A7, just in terms of pure beauty on the outside. And mine has a really weird paint color. It is brilliant blue. Hold on, I'm trying to read it. Magno?
You have the matte blue, don't you?
It's matte blue. Yeah, thank you. It's matte blue.
It's like a matte cobalt.
Ah, brilliant blue Magno.
Yeah. But
I don't know.
Brilliant blue Magno, yes. I don't know. Like I've seen other, you know, matte finishes before. This just seems like a really high quality matte finish. So it looks absolutely amazing, and the wheels are steamrollers. So this it looks like a beast. But actually, this is the GT53, which is the least powerful GT four door you can buy.
So I would make the argument, and I say this having just gotten out of a E53 AMG, which has basically the same powertrain.
Right.
The new 53 models, the new AMG 53 models, are better than the 63s, better than the V8 powered models.
You know, I agree with you. After one day of driving,
it's they so have, good. It's such a good powertrain.
It 429 horsepower, 384.
It's got that electric motor
and,
down
and
low.
Mind you, that's the just kind of like a mild hybrid system. You know, where the electric can kick in and help. But man, it's all mine. Also has the active exhaust where you hit that and it sounds like you're driving the 63 models. I mean, it's
well, the thing is it. It revs so freely and so willingly, and that straight six in that car is just, it's probably the best sounding new engine of the past year. Like it is just a delicious sound. I mean, I couldn't fathom a use case where I would be like, no, I need the 63. The 53 is full stop brilliant.
Also, I'm like, again, I've only driven it like 30 miles or so, but I'm getting like 25 miles per gallon combined.
Oh yeah, I got like 15 in the E53.
But like, I think also the bigger question is not so much should you get the V8, but why would you get the GT53 besides maybe the hatchback being more versatile than the CLS53 or the E53? I like the CLS53's looks the best out of those three personally.
The GT53
I think the CLS is it, but
I like the GT. I'm gonna go. I mean, that's going to be subjective. Let me throw another thing at you though. As good as the exterior is, I find the interior equally awful the other way. It is the most ergonomically challenged car on the inside. There are so many buttons and they're weird buttons. And it took me so long to figure certain things out. And there's so many redundant controls. There's like two buttons about 8 inches from each other that do the exact same thing. One's on the steering wheel and one's on the center console. But they're like 8 inches from each other. Like I mean, I can hit them both with the same hand. At the same time,
that's the new Mercedes interior. Like that's basically the same.
That
one has. I don't remember if I'm looking at it now. It has a trackpad or the touchpad thingamajigger.
Oh, yeah, that too.
It's honestly. I think that this might be a case where you haven't been like I know this because I scheduled your cars. You haven't been in a Mercedes in a minute. And
yeah, I'm gonna give myself the week.
I think that this is a case where, and I'm gonna push back on this really really hard, that interior is actually very, very functional once you kind of adapt to it and like figure out how it works. Because I was just in, like I said, I was just in the E53, which has largely the same controls in the interior, and it makes sense. It's easy to figure out. It's once you know what does what, and I'll admit the learning curve isn't great, the actual functionality there is very, very nice.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I think you can say that about almost any system. If you use it long enough, you'll figure it out and it'll become second nature. Having driven it for an hour, though, I just had tons of questions of either where is this thing that I want that I can't find, or why did they choose to do it this way?
That is one of the few cars on the market like that at this moment you can control everything without taking your hands off the steering wheel. Like that with those touchpads on the steering wheel.
I agree, but I don't know that that's a good thing. Like the steering wheel has so many controls on it, and those weird swipey pads on each side.
The swipey pads are the best part. Like that's
I don't like the swipey pads.
You do not.
I like the theory of it though. I just think the swipey pads don't work that well. I'll take the Audi.
I drove the E53 in for a good 60 miles straight, and I think I took my hands off the steering wheel once during that time.
I'll give it the week and I'll take what you said to heart, but the initial impression has been
the idea of keeping everything on the wheel so you don't have to leave your hand off the wheel and can keep focus, and B, C execution from my experience with those swipey things.
Yeah, maybe that's a good way to put it. All right, so that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow Brandon Turkus on Twitter at Brandon Turkus. You can follow Greg Fink at The Finker, and me at John_M_Neff. I want to thank you two for being here, and especially you, Brandon, for putting on the gloves and getting in the ring with me.
Of course.
And thank you.
And of course, thank all of you out there for listening, and we'll see you next week.